Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information on this, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear the latest from Kate Jean Corbett Pollock. So what's been the latest with your research?
Well, the latest with my research is that I have been learning about something called child death review teams. Child death review teams exist in the United States. I'm not sure about Canada. They exist in all 50 states, and what it is it's a team of people, it's a multidisciplinary team of people that work together on a homicide investigation to assist the forensic pathologist, who is, you know, like the medical examiner, the person who does the autopsy, in understanding the details and the situation around a child death, with what we, you know, a child fatality, to use kind of the language of the field. Because when a child dies, it can be hard for the forensic pathologist to tell if this was a child maltreatment death. Was there child abuse involved in the death? The most common way that children die from abuse is a traumatic head injury, a subdural hematoma, that kind of thing. So blunt head force trauma, blunt force trauma to the head is what happened, unfortunately. And that can be difficult for the forensic pathologist to determine on their own whether that was an accident or if somebody did that to them. And that is why child death review teams have been formed. To assist the forensic pathologist in understanding the circumstances around that case so that the pathologist can make a determination on the cause of death. So often on the team, they're large. Someone from social services is there. The police are involved. Sometimes there is a pastor, you know, from the religious community involved. Child Protective Services, lawyers, all kinds of people are on child death review teams, doctors, people that you would think would, you know how to assist the forensic pathologist. Sometimes the EMT, somebody from that, you know, representing that area. The EMT, when they respond to a scene, that's the emergency people, like what do you call the ambulance? They show up, so the first responders on the scene. And that can teach them a lot about the circumstances surrounding the death of a child because they're going into the house and they're talking with the parents or the adults that are in the house. So that can be really beneficial information to have. And what I would like to see happen, and I'm writing some research, I'm writing a research proposal on this now, is for somebody who has a background in disability studies to be on the child death review teams. And there is a national group that oversees the whole thing, all of the child deaths we've seen in the country. And this death is the National Fatality Prevention, and that's the Center for Fatality Prevention. Getting that right. Anyways, so what they do is they oversee all of these child death review teams, and they also produce research. They work on prevention. They work on a number of different things. So it's really multifaceted, and it's a number of experts that all get together at the National Center. And I was looking on the website and looking, you know, up people who work there, and nobody, there's no disability studies people. There's nobody with a disability background. There's no, as far as I can tell, people that identify as disabled or, you know, working as a disability rights person of, you know, in any kind of field. So I think it would be highly important, and I'm going to submit this, you know, research to them when I'm finished with it, to include more people that understand disability that have a higher degree in disability studies or a related field who have worked in the field, and preferably someone who is disabled themselves. That would be great. That would really be ideal. Maybe a deaf person. It would be great if that person was fluent in sign language, because as we've discussed on the show before, deaf and disabled children are murdered at very high rates. They're murdered at a higher rate than the rest of the population. And they are subject to abuse at much higher rates, depending on the disability. For intellectually disabled people, that can be up to 10 times higher, the abuse rates. Some of the rates of homicide, I haven't seen a lot of research on homicide rates of disabled people. That is something that I feel like this National Center could work on producing. A lot of the research is about abuse.
So, if you could send any message to those who would decide to put someone with a disability on these teams, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say somebody with a disability is going to understand the circumstances of these cases that we're looking at more than anybody else. They just are. They've lived it. You know? And also, we need more representation. So it's good to have disability representation in every field. And especially when it comes to crime, there's just not enough of it. So that is important. And somebody who's deaf, they are going to understand deaf culture better than anybody else, except for maybe a sign language interpreter. Sign language interpreter, I also feel, should be part of this.
So, why do you think it is that children with disabilities are more highly targeted when it comes to things like abuse and homicide rates?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, what I've been working on for years now, and there are many complex reasons for it. I think a big one is that they are vulnerable. They're just vulnerable. And often, the reason that children with disabilities are vulnerable is not necessarily because of the disability in every case, but it's because of how they're raised. A lot of times people don't talk to children with disability, particularly in intellectual disability and deafness, about crime or about perpetrators or about safety or about sex or anything like that. So that is another component. There are so many components to it. But to simplify it, they make a good victim, unfortunately. A predator is looking for somebody who is an easy victim. They do not want a challenge with that, and they don't want to get caught.
So, how do we as a society get away from putting these young lives at risk and provide the appropriate supports to prevent a tragedy before it happens?
Well, I mean, it would have to be a very comprehensive and widespread approach. We are pretty much starting from the beginning, you know, with that kind of thing. I would love to see a federal office started for this specific kind of thing. Somebody, you know, that can spearhead some kind of leadership role, maybe, and just get a lot of people working on it. It's really a huge, huge area that needs a lot of work in a lot of different areas. You know, I mean, the area that I focus on is homeschool. That's just one area. You know, there's so many more, so I think it would take a lot of people working on it together in some sort of unified fashion.
to be honest about it, disability impacts everyone, whether they're immediately recognizing this fact or not. I mean, we're all but one accident away from a disability, so those in power ought to take that into consideration. That could be their own future they're protecting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a natural experience. It's a part of human life. You know, it's never going to go away. It doesn't need to go away. You know, disability's great. You know, I'm disabled. I'm proud. I'm proud of who I am. And a lot of disabled people are. But we need to get real about it. Yes, it can happen to anybody. And if society has, you know, a better approach to disability, then people would feel a lot less depressed and isolated, and there would be more access, you know, for disabled people. Because, yes, it is a universal human experience.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you.
Of course. In this segment of our show, Sarah Fields will be giving us an update on her epilepsy work. So, with this year having been so different, what are some of the successes for your epilepsy work?
With everything changing to virtual and online learning, it's definitely had positives and negatives, but we found that in some of our more remote locations and with some of our classrooms and their busy schedules, it's actually made it a little bit more accessible for us to get in and educate teachers, families, parents, and students all across southwestern Ontario.
So, in terms of education, what aspects of epilepsy do you like to emphasize and get the word out about?
We like to reduce a lot of the myths and the stigma that surround epilepsy and seizure disorders. It's definitely not something that is well talked about in the community, and we find a lot of students and a lot of teachers are unaware of what it can be like to live with epilepsy. So we like to educate everyone that we can just to normalize this a little bit more and let everyone know what it's like to live with epilepsy.
Now you've mentioned that the education process has become a little more accessible. Tell me a little bit about some of the specific techniques you've been using to raise awareness.
So we found that we can not only do our presentations virtually now, but we can also still utilize a lot of the classroom activities that we would normally use if we were physically in the classroom. So it's just a matter of getting the teachers to pick some volunteers for us, but we find that the students are just as engaged when they're sitting and looking at a screen and they're watching myself or one of my colleagues on video and watching our videos that go along with our presentations.
So you mentioned earlier some myths and stigmas surrounding the condition. Can you take me through some of those?
Yeah, so a lot of myths and some stigma is some people just don't understand. They worry that someone who could have a seizure might pass away, or they worry that they could be really seriously injured. And a lot of the times, if the people who are surrounding people with epilepsy and if they know how to care for someone with epilepsy, we find that the recovery period is actually pretty good in a lot of situations. And it's a myth sometimes, especially for younger students, that you could potentially catch epilepsy, that it might be contagious. So we like to eliminate a lot of those myths and let people know that someone living with epilepsy is just like you or I. They're just like anybody else. They just have what we call a lot of the times a special brain.
So are there any challenges in clearing up these misperceptions?
Sometimes there can be, especially when someone hasn't actually witnessed someone have a seizure or when somebody has never met someone who has epilepsy. I think for a lot of people, when they hear the word epilepsy or they hear the word seizure, they automatically think of a convulsive seizure. And that's only one of the types of seizures that exist. There are actually very many seizure disorders and different types of seizures. So we find that it's really important to let people know that seizures can look a number of different ways, and they can manifest differently for different people. Even two people who have the same type of epilepsy and have the same type of seizures, their seizures can actually look a lot different.
So, in terms of the awareness work, mostly of this past year, I'm wondering, has there been any success story which you've been able to really get the word out about the epilepsy work that's going on?
Well, for instance, our annual gala, which is normally held every April, that was changed up a little bit this year, and it was held actually in November. But because our physical gala that's held every year is normally in London, Ontario, it can make accessibility a little bit difficult sometimes for some people to get to. But for instance, because everything was virtual this year and because we're utilizing the virtual platforms that we have access to, there were people from all across southwestern Ontario who were able to attend. And again, like I mentioned, a lot of those remote areas, we've been able to get into those remote areas who it might be difficult to get transportation there, or it might be difficult for our clients to have transportation. But when people can meet from the comfort of their own home, we find that our presentations can actually last longer, we can actually engage more with our clients, and it's really a more comfortable environment for everybody, for the client and also for us as well.
What would you like the community to know about epilepsy as a condition? If you could send any message about it, what would you say?
What I would say is that epilepsy and seizures are a little bit more common than we might think. It's actually possible, and the statistics are such so that actually 1 in 10 people will have a seizure at some point in their life. And we want it to be something that is talked about freely, it's talked about normally, and it's something that a lot of people will understand. So an example that I like to give in the classroom, especially for little kids, is if a little kid gets a bump on their knee and they start to bleed, they know that they have to go get a Band-Aid. They know exactly what to do, that they need first aid. And we want to normalize that sort of behavior the same if somebody has a seizure, so that someone will know exactly what to do if they see someone have a seizure. So really asking those questions and understanding that people with epilepsy, they might have seizures, but they're still a wonderful human being. They're just the same as anybody else.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thanks, Ken.
Of course.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Whether you're enjoying a feast with the family, participating in your local pub crawl, or just indulging in some eggnog, please drink responsibly over the holidays. Designate a sober driver, call a taxi, a friend, or just stay over. Thank you for always driving sober. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about epilepsy from Sarah Fields, and a little bit about Kate Pollock's latest disabilities research.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Myra Covery, who'll be sharing her story of overcoming a trauma. So tell me a little bit about your trauma survival story.
I'm a classical harpist, and I was studying a harp in Cleveland, Ohio, with the principal harpist of the Cleveland Orchestra at that time. This is 1977. And I pulled a muscle in my hand playing the harp, and a doctor suggested that I try a Valium as a muscle relaxant. And apparently I didn't tolerate the Valium, but I had no idea. I'd never taken anything like that before. And I got very high, but it was helping with the muscle relaxing part of it, so I kept on using it. the doctor said it was okay, but that was a mistake. And I got higher and higher. The people that I was living with at the time got concerned and had me taken to a psychiatric hospital, emergency room. And I was, well, the story of the admission is not the trauma part, but I apparently, I signed myself in there voluntarily, but I didn't understand what I had to do in order to get out, and I asked them to explain it to me, and they said, oh, just go up to the unit and we'll explain it to you there. So it turned out that I couldn't sign myself out, and I got very scared, and I was having trouble sleeping in this place, and they gave me medication. I had bad reactions to that medication. Basically, they didn't believe me, I think, of what was causing the problem. And I got really, really, they ended up shooting me up with Thorazine about a week after I'd been in there. And I got very, very frightened that they were going to do electroshock, because I had a friend who was a medical student who interned in this facility, and I knew that they did electroshock there. And I became literally scared stiff. Literally, medical people there diagnosed me catatonic and recommended electroshock. I was 24 years old at the time. They didn't really need my parents' permission, but thankfully they did contact my parents, and my parents and my family made arrangements for me to have me transferred to another institution, which took about another 2 weeks, and I was on very, very heavy doses of Stelazine, I think 40 milligrams a day, which is really a lot, and I was having very bad reactions to that too, but mostly physical reactions, not the catatonia that I had had from the Thorazine. So that's how this started, and that trauma of that has been with me.
So, how did you go about dealing with the post-traumatic stress and the memories that came with your time in the institution and the fear associated?
I had a therapist who used this, what's called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. And I've been doing that quite regularly, and particularly focusing on the trauma of the the experience of forced psychiatry, which for me was really like torture. My experience of it was that I was being tortured.
So
I've been working hard with this eye movement therapy, which was developed for dealing with post-traumatic stress for Vietnam veterans here in the United States. And I'm finding it to be effective. It's taken a while, but my stress coping mechanism seems to be I'm less easily triggered into a panic state since I've been working on this.
So, can you tell me a little bit about some of the milestones you've passed in your recovery?
I really think that it's been a very long, slow process, and I can't point to specific milestones, but I did, about 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, I guess, I started seeing an alternative medical practitioner who changed my diet and gave me some supplements that are supposed to help, nutritional supplements and hormonal supplements, and I've been doing the eye movement desensitization. And the combination of that, I would say in the last 6 months, I actually feel like I've made progress. Whenever I've been in a situation where I'm experiencing some kind of shock, which happens, unfortunately, in life relatively often, I've noticed that my physiological reaction is less, the physiological part is not driving me, and my brain is able to engage.
So,
more quickly to do the problem solving that I need to do rather than just being completely freaked out.
So can you tell me a little bit about how the eye therapy works? What exactly you need to do in order to desensitize yourself?
This is a process with a use with a therapist, and there are different ways of doing it, but the way that my therapist does it, she sets up a scenario. Well, I set up the scenario with her guidance of what the target memory is that I want to work on, and I make a visual image in my mind of what the worst part of that looks like, and she does some rating on a scale system having to do with negative and positive responses, and asks me to focus on that image and focus on the memory, and then she moves her hand. I'm supposed to follow her fingers, and she moves her hand kind of like windshield wiper off to the side, and my go left to right following that. And she does it for about, I don't know, maybe a minute, 45 seconds, a minute, and then I rest and talk to her about what came up, and then we do it again. And it can go on as long as I have stamina for. And it usually, the whole process usually takes about an hour and a half, and at the end of it, she again asks me to rate the positive and negative reactions on a scale of 0 to 7 or 1 to 10 or whatever, the two different scales. And so the amplitude, the rating, when I rate that on that scale, the amplitude of the distress has been going down recently. So I'm optimistic that this will be helpful in preventing future breakdowns, psychotic episodes. But I can't say, as I have proof, that it's going to work.
So can you tell me a little bit about how doing some advocating for other survivors has helped you in your...
Yes. When this first happened to me, my first thought was to sue the original institution. And it was out of state from where I lived. It was complicated. And I wasn't able to follow through on that. But I did, at that time, I think it was 1979, I put my name, I found out about a publication called Madness Network News that was linking up people who had been through similar experiences of surviving psychiatry, forced psychiatry. And I put my name on a list there of being a contact person. And I ended up forming a group here in Ithaca, New York, called the Mental Patients Alliance of Central New York, and met other survivors. And we started speaking out at college classes and trainings for healthcare, social workers, healthcare providers. And I found that to be very, very empowering. Eventually, I think in the early 2000s, at the United Nations, they were negotiating a treaty on rights of persons with disabilities. And I got involved as a representative of an organization here based in the United States called Mind Freedom International, and advocating for an end to forced psychiatry. And it took several years, but the convention text was adopted in 2006, and under international law, at this point in time, the interpretation of the convention is, by the treaty body monitoring committee, the interpretation is that forced psychiatric intervention is a human rights violation and illegal. And the process for me of going through that experience was lifted me up out of a kind of a funk of feeling like there was something wrong with me to knowing that there's something wrong out there in the world. And if I can do something about it, then that has helped to my recovery.
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.